All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got Scott St. John on the line with us. He's with Red Dirt Energy. May know him from Regan Smith as well, but Red Dirt Energy is where he's been focused for a couple of years now, at least a year and a half. And we're going to find out more about what's going on with that. Steve Bakken also on the program. Steve, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Not too bad. And Mr. Excuse me there for a second. Scott St. John, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
I had a little coffee in my throat there while I was going to do the introduction, and I had a one of those after burps come in, so I do apologize to everybody out there. Red Dirt Energy. Now, let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, the parent company, Regan Smith, talk about them, and then how just the genesis behind Red Dirt Energy, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so Regan Smith is a company that's been around for almost 20 years now. And we started off rather small, about three people, 19 years ago. And our focus is projects on federal lands and Indian lands. Oklahoma, not a lot of people know this, but Oklahoma has a ton of both federal and Indian lands. More on the mineral side of things, not necessarily on the surface side of things, especially when it comes to federal lands. But Indian lands, it's very checkerboard. I can go into the history of how all of that kind of goes, but everybody knows we're the Sooner State, why we're the Sooner State. It used to be just Indian territory. We opened it up, and that's where the land run came into play. And then there was the people that came in sooner rather than later. And so, yeah, Regan Smith focuses on the federal side of things, drilling permits on BLM, BIA, Forest Service, you name it. We work all across the country. So as a genesis to Red Dirt Energy, we saw a niche a couple of years ago when the Biden administration unleashed a tremendous amount of funds to clean up well sites. So we started Red Dirt Energy as a plugging company, seeing that was going to be, we thought, a good business model to get into, kind of turned our knowledge. We kind of share resources between the two companies, but with our knowledge of, you know, wells and how they're drilled and, you know, soup to nuts in the oil and gas industry, I would say, from the land side of things to the environmental side of things, we thought that starting a plugging company would fit right in. My background is engineering, and also I've got a law degree. So kind of work both sides of policy on that, as well as the engineering side. So yeah, we started about 2.5 years ago in earnest. Red Dirt Energy has been around for a while, but as far as a plugging company, it's been about 2.5 years, and we've probably plugged in the neighborhood of 150 to 200 wells, primarily working on state funded or, you know, federally funded projects for the state of Oklahoma. We've now moved into Texas. We've had a couple of, last year we completed a large project for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They had 25 wells on a wildlife refuge here in Oklahoma that needed to be plugged. We were able to secure that contract. Now we've moved into Texas, and we just got a big contract with the Osage Nation. So we're super excited about that.
You know, Scott, there's a lot of synergy, and I think a lot of people don't realize it between Oklahoma and North Dakota when you start taking a look at the federal lands, the BLM lands, the tribal lands. Very, very similar between North Dakota and Oklahoma. When sure. You're looking at working through, because you have to work with so many multiple layers when you're looking at different agencies on the federal side. I mean, even just from the federal side within different departments, if you're looking at direct federal lands versus BLM lands versus U.S. Game and Fish lands, walk us through some of the different layers, because that can be mind-numbing, the paperwork and the channels you have to go through. What is that challenge like when you're trying to do projects that are incredibly beneficial? Because we went through that same phase too. That's why I say there's a lot of synergy between North Dakota and Oklahoma with the abandoned and orphan wells and getting making sure that those are secured correctly. And walk us through the process when you're dealing with so many multiple jurisdictional agencies on trying to do a project.
Yeah. So, it's interesting for, so for here in Oklahoma, I would say, one of the distinctions here is we have a lot of allotted lands, not necessarily, tribal, people think of big, tribal reservations. Oklahoma is very checkerboard where it's allotted lands and those are governed, those are held in trust by the federal government, by the BIA. And then also, so you can have the BIA as a layer. You can also have included in that would be the tribe as another layer if they have interest in those minerals. And then when you're dealing with those two entities, they actually sort of delegate some of their authority to the BLM as far as the technical side of things. So you can have a project that has BIA, a tribe entity, and then also BLM. And depending on where you're at, you could also have a potential where there is core jurisdiction if you have a wetland issue or something like that. So yeah, there can be several layers and it is very challenging because everyone, even it's all, you know, the process is the same to a large extent, but each office and each BIA office has their own little, projects or their own interests that they want to preserve or that they are interested in, it's just something they want to protect or something. So you have to understand first who you're dealing with, what BIA agency you're dealing with, what tribe you're dealing with. And then, you know, there is a lot of politics at play at times. It's good to, you know, we've been doing this 19 years from the Reagan Smith side of things. And it is very interesting to, you know, we've developed these relationships, especially here in Oklahoma over the years and know who the players are and know kind of how to navigate those things. I mean, sometimes we get tripped up for sure, but, it is a definitely, experience plays a large role in knowing who wants what, when and where, and how they want it done. And then you add the BLM on there where, on the technical side, the drilling side, or even the plugging side of things, where they have their own engineers and they have their own likes, and each engineer within the BLM has their own interests that they want to see things done a certain way. Yes, knowing all of those things and having that experience definitely plays a role. But there was several years early on in my career doing this that was very challenging. And it still is today when people leave, new people come in. So yeah, there is that potential to have layers. We have a project right now in Texas where we've got Forest Service, we've got Fish and Wildlife, and we've got the Corps of Engineers all in one project. It is a challenge.
I want to talk about the Fish and Wildlife Project in a moment here, but just to give perspective to the listeners out there, how things have changed. 10 years ago, I'm interviewing Missouri River Resources and the MHA Nation, Mandan Hadicera. How do you pronounce that, Steve? Sorry,
Pop. Mandan, Hadatsa, and Arikara.
Thank you. Their leadership has been very open and very accessible to reporters and to different individuals. And so one of the things that opened my eyes, you talk about politics, you know, Missouri River Resources and the MHA Nation, they're trying to empower Native Americans through the energy industry. And the federal government, through the BIA and the BLM, they've got a 47-step process for this Native American reservation to go drill. When you or I or Steve or any other American outside of there can do it in 3 days. When they were talking about the difference between 47-step process, which in the government can be 3 years, versus 3 days, that opened my eye. And I know that Senator Hoeven, as much as, you know, I'll come down on him from time to time about some of the things, he was extremely instrumental in streamlining a lot of that BLM process. So for the people out there, when we talk about what used to be, that's what it was like. It was sometimes 2-3 years. Are you finding any of that politics is still existent with the orphan wells or the abandoned wells on the reservation, Scott?
Well, so I would say that right now, no, because everyone's trying to get things done. The money is limited. Really, what's going on here is there have been federal grants provided to individual tribes, and the tribes have had to apply for these grants to plug wells on their lands, on their jurisdictional lands, if you will. The first round came out about a year ago, and that money was approved through several tribes this year, or late last year, and the tribes are just now trying to get their arms around it. But one of the challenges there is the first round of grants was really pointed towards allotted lands and tribal reservation lands. The second round, oddly enough, was only it excluded allotted lands. So that's been a challenge for a lot of the tribes in Oklahoma because they have so much allotted lands and not necessarily the reservation lands. So that's been a challenge for a lot of the tribes in Oklahoma is now all of a sudden their footprint has shrunk insofar as what they can plug. And so that's been a challenge. But insofar as what's going on now is the grants have been issued. They do have funding, but the tribes don't have the expertise and the resources, human resources, to manage these things. A lot of times these tribes don't even know where all their allotted lands are. And a lot of times they've been severed, especially in Oklahoma, where you've got surface severed from the mineral estate. So that's challenging to research in and of itself as well. And some of these tribes are you know, having a hard time determining what exactly they own from an allotted lands perspective. So those sort of things are you know, challenges, not necessarily from the grant side of things. There is a NEPA requirement, but it's very low level NEPA. It would be a categorical exclusion type of situation. It's not an environmental assessment, but there is a NEPA component to it because it is federally funded. So, but yeah, I know what you're talking about when you're talking about these, you know, this laundry list of requirements just to get something done. And then when you kind of add in to the equation the politics involved, it can be very frustrating. I know
in North Dakota it was becoming a divisive issue because literally you could go across the street and drill. I mean, it was just like
right.
I mean, what's going on here?
You know, one of the things that early on 10 years ago, you know, early on when it seemed like there was an influx of young people, younger professionals coming into the oil and gas industry. One of the things that we had to educate them on was, even though you're not on, you know, you would be drilling a federal lease, whether it's a BIA lease or a BLM lease, you may not necessarily have the surface. The surface would be privately owned. So what a lot of people were assuming was, I don't have to do anything because I'm not on federal surface or BIA surface or tribal surface. That's not the case. As soon as if you know that your drill bit is going to penetrate a federal lease, whether it be BLM or BIA lease, and you're on private surface, you've got to get a permit and you've got to walk through all the NEPA steps and the NHPA, which is the National Historic Preservation Act. So that's the misnomer in a lot of cases. is that surface severed from the mineral estate.
Mm-hmm.
So
I wanted to ask too about the carbon market, and then we'll get into the game and fish. So is this kind of being categorized as a carbon management area of government, or is this, you know, coming in from just specifically oil and gas, or is there any sort of certain earmark that this is coming from? Because it sounds like the business or the grants or the funds are coming from the government.
Yeah. So right now, I think the carbon market as it relates to orphaned wells and plugging wells is really the wild west right now. So you have American Carbon Registry, which came out with guidelines specifically and only to orphaned wells as it relates to getting carbon credits for methane emissions when you plug an orphaned well. You've got another company out there called Carbon Path that has guidelines for obtaining carbon credits for orphaned wells and private wells. So they've added another layer. The driver to all of this is ESG and ESG scores. Red Dirt is actually working for we're under an NDA and I can't speak a lot about it, but we're actually working with a company a global company out of New York, and we are doing some pilot projects to determine really what the market is like, if it's lucrative, does it make money when you're to obtain carbon credits when you're plugging wells, plugging orphaned wells. So the challenge there is do you have enough emissions, and is it cost effective to go through all the steps, which is, you know, step one is measuring. Do we have, you know, you're going to measure those emissions. You've got to pay for that. That's about $10,000. Then you've got the verification process, which you have to hire a third party certified company, MIQ, Project Canary, those kind of guys to verify your emissions. Then you go through the process of plugging the well and getting those carbon credits. And then whatever that carbon credit is worth, we don't, you know, it's that fluctuates. So the upfront costs of even getting the carbon credit is, you know, it's very hard to recoup that from that perspective. So that's kind of the pilot projects we're going through right now, is really you want to target the gas wells. The shallow oil wells are not going to be very prolific in methane emissions. And then you're going to have winners and losers out of those gas wells that you're plugging. And from the ACR perspective, the American Carbon Registry, their guidelines only speak to orphan wells. You get in a very gray area when you're talking about private wells and plugging those wells for carbon credits, because you have to meet a certain, you just can't go, you know, you have to meet certain criteria for that well to be eligible to get carbon credits for. So, and also the argument is, who gets the carbon credits on private, you know, actual producing wells? Is it the mineral owner? Is it the operator? Is it the surface owner? Do you divide it up to all of them? There's a big gray legal area there that hasn't been well established.
But yes, Scott, the engineering firm would like that. But anyway, Steve, go ahead.
Jason. Like,
Steve, think about this analogy. Your background is music, even country music. If you were within a 3-block radius of a country music song being written, people were trying to claim ownership of that record. So, I mean, this is the same thing, Steve.
That's right. On private wells. Yeah. That on private producing wells. Absolutely. It's going to be an interesting, see how that shakes out.
Well, and I don't think people really fathom the
grandiose nature of the value of a carbon credit yet. So, and that's a discussion for a different time. You know, one thing that you mentioned, trying to navigate between the surface rights and the mineral rights. And one of the things that popped into my head, because we're dealing with this in North Dakota right now with carbon sequestration projects, and this goes back to some legislation back in 2012 in North Dakota that tied the surface rights to the pore space rights.
Uh-huh.
So now
that's
you've
exactly
got,
right. Yes.
Now you've got mineral rights, surface rights, pore space. Uh-huh. So differently, are you dealing with any of those pore space issues like we deal with in North Dakota with what you're working through, or is that not really a thing in other places yet?
So no, it's not. I'll kind of take you back in history of what you're talking about. I'm familiar with, because in 2007, we were approached by a think tank, a startup company out of Harvard University. There were some grad students that started a company and wanted to do this carbon sequestration stuff only on federal lands. Well, at the time, this was prior to any legislation or any rule promulgation of class six injection wells. We had the first applications out to the feds, the BLM particularly, because we wanted to inject that, you know, that's where we were going to inject the carbon into was federal lands in their pore space. And they had no mechanism at the time to approve that action. And we for years, a couple of years, we were working with the BLM to get something done on that, but it never went anywhere. But that was kind of the, you know, and here we are almost 20 years later, that situation has kind of started up again with the carbon sequestration, pore space, that kind of stuff. We're not seeing any high-level projects here in Oklahoma on the carbon capture and sequestration issues, but it's coming. We just haven't seen it yet.
So when you're looking at how states like Oklahoma or Texas are potentially going to navigate that, because it is coming, like I said, back in 2012, North Dakota passed some legislation that tied them together. Now, through further investigation, there's also a little appendage on a second piece of legislation that, in essence, rolls sequestration projects over to the state and gives the state ownership of those projects, which I think we're going to have a Supreme Court battle coming up, because sure. If the state owns the project, then by default, that previous legislation, the state owns the surface rights. So has there been any discussion legislatively in states like Oklahoma or Texas on how to navigate that? Because it is something that's coming to other states like it has in North Dakota. And in North Dakota, it goes back to 2012.
Yeah. So not that I'm aware of from the perspective of pore space. I will say that And I always think Oklahoma is, you know, they're so slow in what they do and how they react to different markets.
We say that about things. North Dakota. Wait a minute here.
No, I bet everybody thinks about that, you know, but, you know, I would say as much as I think Californians are crazy and that kind of thing, they have their stuff together with respect to the carbon markets and what they're doing over there. I'm not one that is, you know, thinks that we should jump on board and do what California is doing, but they're way ahead of the ball game on that kind of stuff. I will say that Oklahoma just passed some legislation last year that allows the state to basically jump into the carbon credit market with methane emissions as it relates to these orphaned wells that we're plugging for the state. That's great, but the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, which is the oil and gas, you know, basically the agency that's over oil and gas here in Oklahoma, they have to then take that legislation and promulgate rules to define how to measure how to obtain those carbon credits and who gets them and how they're out, how the funds from that's reaped from the carbon credits, how they're going to be allocated. I mean, it's a whole mess of a show here of, you know, the state legislator did a fine job of passing that legislation, but now it's the next step of getting the agency over that to actually get the rules in place. And that's going to take years. The federal funds for plugging wells and doing what we're doing now is going to be dried up by the time we get any kind of rules on the books.
I kind of look at the carbon market as, it's very interesting because I'll give another analogy. One of the analogies I used to give in the energy industry was that, to me, from a political standpoint, it seemed like California and New York were places where they would like introduce kind of extreme legislation, you know, banning gas stoves. I call that extreme legislation.
Yeah, that's, it's crazy, political, right?
Well, it's just, it's extreme. It's really different. It's like, okay, we just spent 20 years giving tax credits for people to upgrade to natural gas, and within 2 years, now you're saying I got to get rid of it. That's extreme behavior. That's not normal behavior. But California mm-hmm. and New York seem to introduce that a lot. And then they would play it out in Colorado. That was what I thought was weird. It was like they were kind of playing, not play it in Peoria like the old days. It's like, let's test it out in Colorado. I almost see that happening in the carbon market with North Dakota, Wyoming, and now Louisiana just got privacy as well. So there are three states that, you know, one of the reasons North Dakota can kind of have a history with this is because of that I call it the super EPA ruling, where they get to kind of be their own EPA. And then, uh-huh. you know, you take a look at the BLM from a federal. It's almost like there are some states trying to do a grassroots or trying to figure it out on the local level, but there is also this body of work on a federal, whether it be through the BLM or the BIA or whatever it might be, to where it does seem like there's almost like a top and a bottom approach to where it is going to meet somewhere in the middle. I don't know if it's going to like happen quickly, if it's going to take a couple of years, but I do see where there are a couple different vehicles driving it to where I hope they meet somewhere someday, because I don't know if they're going in different directions or the same directions, but they're driving different vehicles. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah. And I think to a large extent, and I really wish this would go on is I think it happens to a certain degree, but I'm hopeful that someday these, you know, the large oil and gas states, and this is for any industry, but the conservation agencies, if you will, that manage the oil and gas, I wish that the states like Wyoming, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Colorado, I wish they would all kind of come together and have a consortium and brainstorm some common sense approach to these larger issues and sort of come to a consensus on what's best. But then again, you could say, well, what's best for Colorado is not best for Oklahoma. I get that, but there could be some a think tank or something like that where these agencies come together and try to come up with common or very similar rules and how they apply, so that some of these things can come together quicker. I think what happens is you have some states that are very proactive, like Colorado, and others like Oklahoma that are not so proactive, and they kind of do a wait and see approach instead of doing anything. And I think that hurts the state to a large degree. But I think also on the flip side, Colorado is super proactive, and their rules are very, I think, have been very detrimental to the oil and gas industry. But that's up to the, that's in large degree by who lives there now. So
we're talking with Scott St. John. I'm Steve Bakken along with Jason Spies. And, there's one other layer in that, Scott, is, the politics. And I agree with you. A consortium would be a great idea on fairly like-minded states to come up with at least a baseline plan. But now you start getting the local politics involved, and I think that's where a lot of things wind up going off the rails for a myriad of reasons. So I want to talk a little bit about the game and fish contract you've got, because that to me is fascinating. And from a federal perspective, you know, we've got Theodore Roosevelt National Park here in North Dakota, so we deal with some federal projects on a grander scale, especially when we're fighting trying to keep horses in the park, but different discussion for a different day. But federal level, when you're looking at game and fish contracts, how does that manage? Because I know our oil and gas industry here in North Dakota has done a lot of work in around navigating our federal park. And then you throw game and fish lands onto that, which is an entirely different entity than BLM or other federal lands. Walk us through that contract, what that looks like from a navigational perspective.
Yeah, so there were a couple layers even internally with that contract. One was one of the, you know, it obviously the solicitation went through the sams.gov website. And then once you secure that contract, you have a contract administrator, which is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You have another contract administrator, which is in California. You have your the person responsible for paying us and the billing side of things was in an entirely different state. And so you're dealing with all these different time zones. Then you have the actual project manager on site, which is a biologist who knew nothing about oil and gas, nothing about plugging wells. So you had all these different players, and what the Fish and Wildlife did here in Oklahoma is they basically delegated technical authority to the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, which is they're over oil and gas here. So you were dealing with those layers. And one of the challenges was, you know, one of the things I brought up immediately was, okay, you know, we bid these wells, excuse me, individually. So each well had its own individual bid. And one of my questions, what happens a lot when you're plugging a well is you may get, you know, 700 feet down the well, or you're pulling tubing and your tubing breaks, or, you know, you've pulled that tubing apart. You can't get down there. You got to get a tool. You've got all this extra time and material. Or on the flip side of things, you've got another technical problem where you've got collapsed casing or something happens in the middle of plugging the well where you need some, A, you need some technical guidance, and B, you need approval to spend more money to get that well plugged properly. That process, if I had one complaint, that process was rather slow. On a normal basis, you'd get an answer within 15 minutes. The answers were coming in not 15 minutes, but 24 to 48 hours. So we made our best efforts to have faith in the system and just move on and get that well plugged and finished in the hopes that we would justify everything later on and justify that cost overrun and get paid for that cost overrun. But initially I asked that question of, hey, I need answers in 15 minutes. Are you going to be able to do that? And their response was 24 to 48 hours. So right there told me that they don't know what they're dealing with. When it comes to plugging wells, how quickly you need answers. You've got rigs, you've got other equipment standing by, you've got all these things, you know, it's almost like drilling a well, but in reverse, right? Time is money. Everything happens quick. You need to get this stuff done. So that was one of the biggest challenges. And then also, you know, the Fish and Wildlife would defer to the OCC in a lot of ways, in a lot of things, but then they also wanted to be in on all the conversations that we would have with OCC. So there was a high level of technical conversation going on, and then you would have to turn around and explain everything to a biologist and draw it on a piece of paper of what you're trying to accomplish. I will give her credit, the biologist out there, she picked up pretty quickly, within about a month of all the technical things that we were talking about. But those were some challenges. And then, like I said before, the different time zones we were dealing with the contract administrations, and then requesting change orders when we were looking at an overrun. So those were some challenges from a technical aspect. You know, we didn't even know what we were getting into when we bid this project out, as far as we made our best guess. A lot of these wells didn't have well records. So we used offset wells as our best guess. And then sometimes you would just get in that well and it'd be easy breezy. Sometimes you'd get into a well that would take 7 or 8 days that was, 1500 feet deep. So it just depended on, kind of where you were at. But definitely those were some of the challenges, and we were able to get it done, and the time allowed was 3 months to execute this contract, and we were able to get it done in 3 months. But we had the other challenge of daylight to dusk. So we had to shut down when we had to shut down. That was a challenge as well. And also just being around some of the sensitivities of the refuge, the terrain, and the soil was super sandy. So we had to get three wreckers out to pull out one of our rigs one time, and to the tune of about a $7,000 bill just to get that rig out. So there were definitely some challenges along the way.
And this is with the U.S. Game and Fish, right? Wildlife.
Yeah, this was U.S. Fish and Wildlife. They have a, it's called the Deep Fork Wildlife Refuge. It's in Okmulgee County, Oklahoma.
Okay. And you mentioned that the state of Texas is next, or you're currently doing some work down there.
So we've got a sort of similar to what we've been doing in Oklahoma. They're using federal funds, and we secured, I think there's about 20 pluggers that secured some portion of their budget, to plug wells. They're a little different in this, I think this is the second round of that IIJA money, is that there is a, I've mentioned NEPA before. There's a NEPA component now, which we thought was kind of odd that there wasn't a NEPA component in the first place. Because let me back up just a second for those that don't know, NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. You've got to comply with when projects are federally funded, or there is a federal nexus with that project, you have to comply with certain environmental rules. As it applies to those projects, and that's you can you, it falls under NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act. So this second round with Texas, they actually have to analyze every well from a NEPA perspective and a cultural resource perspective, before it can be plugged. So I think Texas got hung up on that. Oklahoma is facing the same thing. I'm sure North Dakota is going to face the same thing, that, now there's this added layer of federal involvement before you can go out and plug these wells. So that is delaying things to a significant degree. I think Texas was ready to rock and roll back in March, and we still haven't even got our first set of wells yet because they're under NEPA review.
Quite a change, isn't
So,
it? Huh. I mean,
yeah, right. I mean, I think that's what Oklahoma's facing. Oklahoma ran out of their first round of money. They're supposed to get the money, another round of money in October or November, and they're telling us to expect delays beyond that because now we have to comply. And here's the other problem. when you're dealing with state agencies like this, they don't understand the federal NEPA, categorical exclusion, environmental assessment, NHPA. They don't understand that stuff. They don't ever have to deal with it. So that's another layer of getting everybody educated on what needs to be done.
Well, Steve Bach, and I know you've got a county meeting you've got to run to. You've got to put your legislative hat on or your county commissioner hat on.
And, I do. Do you have any... It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Great to meet you, Steve.
And I appreciate you coming on today, Scott. And
yeah, thanks, Jason. I really us a little it. Bit.
Yeah, it's you know, the thing that people want to know about is, you know, what's going on out there with a lot of these orphan wells, because, you know, there was this kind of this mad dash for a while where some companies, you know, were getting millions of dollars and they haven't even plugged a well. And so it's good to know that there are companies out there that are doing it. They are, you know, companies that have ethics and values and have experience. And so Red Dirt Energy, one of those companies. Where do you direct people for if they want more information, Scott?
Our website. I think we are one of the only plugging companies that has a website, which is very valuable. But yeah, it's www.reddirtenergy.net. And that will get you to our website, and my contact information's on there. My email is sstjohn@reddirtenergy.net. So if you want to contact me directly, that's perfectly fine.